what I'd like to do today is share with you my passion for language and my passion for what's been called the miracle of language. Why is language said to be a miracle? The marvel. In part, it's said to be thought to be one of the most miraculous things we do with the human brain because of the kinds of problems that we solve when we're doing this. So, for example, as I'm speaking to you now, there's just a continuous stream of sound that's going through the air. Yet somehow your brain segments these sounds and gives you the sensation of having meaning. And the computations that you're doing to achieve those meanings and the rate at which you're doing it are so extraordinary that people have marveled at the complexity of the human brain that allows this to happen. And it naturally led to us asking, how did we develop this capacity? Where does the capacity come from? To what extent is this capacity similar to other animals? To what extent is what we're doing now just similar to general animal communication? And what's in the brain and what's in the environment that gives rise to this extraordinary capacity that we have now. Now, in my own work, I've been interested in understanding a fundamental problem. We know that the baby at about 12 months old, over here on my right, I guess your right as well, we know that the baby at about 12 months old already has quite a spectacular range of capacities for human language. For example, the baby by 12 months old has a rudimentary phonological system from which they will draw all the words of human language, of their native language. We also know that they have already the basic foundations of reference. That by 12 months old, most normally developing babies are already saying their first, have already embarked upon their first word. We know that they have a rich array of communicative intentions and ability to express them. And we already know that they have the basic structure of conversational patterns. So, for example, a child by this age, and actually at around age three months, by this age will be silent when you're vocalizing and will vocalize when you're silent. So there's already the basic structure of a conversation upon which they're going to begin hanging their knowledge of language. And now we contrast that with the moment of birth. Now all of us know that babies have quite an impressive array of capacities at birth, and they know a lot, but all parties agree that between birth and 12 months, something has happened that makes this child have those capacities at 12 months. And the question is, what happened? What happened in between from birth and 12 months to even allow the child to embark upon the complex processes of learning a language? Now, my research program has tried to focus on the brain and the environment and the kinds of contributions that each give. I've asked the question, is there a dedicated genetic neural basis for language? Okay, it could be that there's nothing. Maybe there is none, as many have argued. Today, however, after 20 years of work, actually 30 years of work, I'm going to argue very strongly that there's tissue in the human brain that's literally dedicated to detecting and processing highly specific patterns of natural language. This is a booster rocket, all right? This is nature's mechanism that gives the child, to thrust the child into the right attentional space to begin the course of learning a language. This is the antithesis of a connectionist model. I am going to argue that any theory that's presented to you that argues that the human brain is just neuronal soup and somehow, through interacting with the environment, language somehow magically gets in there and is learned entirely through environmental input, does not have explanatory adequacy. Explanatory adequacy means it cannot account for all facts of human language acquisition. So having come to this conclusion, it provides us with a new understanding of what makes us human and unique from all other animals, particularly chimpanzees. It also gives us insights into the evolutionary origins of language, why and how language evolved. And finally, it gives us insights into how and why young babies can acquire language. Today, I will only focus on this particular aspect, but later on when we have a discussion, I'll be happy to talk to you about these other features. Now, to argue you today that tissue in the brain is dedicated to detecting and processing highly specific patterns in natural language, and that this is the mechanism that kickstarts the system, jumpstarts the human child into the language acquisition process. I'm going to draw from a variety of studies that I've done over the last 30 years. I began my career at Columbia University in the mid-70s, raising a chimpanzee in an attempt to teach it sign language. I then moved to studying the milestones that all children achieve in their early life in early language acquisition. I then discovered that profoundly deaf babies exposed to sign language actually babble on their hands at the right developmental moment. We'll talk a little bit about that. I then moved to studies of whether there's handedness in sign babbling, and found that there is left-hand bias in children who are babbling, which indicates, there's a left hemisphere lateralis, so this right hemisphere right-hand bias when a child is babbling, and that indicates that the left hemisphere is controlling that function, and that's distinct from how they use their hands in a general way. I also went on to study the rhythmic patterning that underlies babbling. This is the rhythmicity that forms the glue that holds that little bite-sized nugget together, the syllabic nugget, the ba 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 ba, da 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 da. What is the rhythmic pattern that underlies that? I then went on to do studies of brain scanning involving the brain scanning of adult language, the representation, what tissue is involved in the use of language. I then went on to look at new morphometry studies where we look at the volume, very detailed analyses, voxel by voxel, of the volume of gray and white tissue matter underlying human language processing and the tissue that we use when we engage in language. I looked at new studies that I'll report today on left hemisphere involvement and mediation of very early babbling, as early as 5 months, and that's distinct from other vocalizations that children make. And finally, I have a very large research program now looking at the impact of the age of exposure on young children, and here I'm referring to a very nice experiment in Nature as young bilingual children who are exposed to two languages either from birth, and then we follow them through the developmental course, or we look at children who are going to be bilingual, but they had one language at birth, and then at age 3, they were exposed to their second language intensely. Then another group where I got one language from birth, and at age 5, they were exposed to two languages intensely. Another group who had one language from birth, and then at age 7, the second language was exposed intensely, 9, and 12. Why would I use those ages to look at, to ask questions about maturational impact of the exposure of a language? Does anyone know why? Why would I look at age 3, 5, 7 to 9, and 12? 12 to 15. Pardon me?
No,
it doesn't, actually. It coincides with, but a good guess, it coincides with key ages of maturation of brain development. So we're trying to look at whether there's a critical period for learning language and whether or not the human brain is differentially sensitive to the critical periods in language acquisition. We look at language exposure for the first time as it's impacted, not for the first time ever. These are not radical, where the lots in a box or whatever. But language exposure at these key ages, and we look at the neural representation in the brain as opposed to whether it was early or late language exposure. Also, you can imagine this has very important implications for education as to when is the optimal age to expose children to two languages. Okay, so today I'm going to be focusing for you on what you see in the bubbles, but I will cover the more broad range of topics just to give you situate the question that I will discuss today. So, as I said, while I have a passionate interest in human language acquisition, my work with humans did not begin right away. My work in language acquisition actually began with the study of a chimpanzee. excuse me. Here you see, I was an undergraduate at Columbia University, and I raised Nim Chimpsky. This is a project that was attempting to teach sign language to an infant chimpanzee. To give you, why would we have done this? Well, it was hypothesized at the time that aspects of language were under biological control. So to test this hypothesis, aspects of language should be species specific. So what we did, I lived with the chimpanzee for 3.5 years. I actually thought I had a normal undergraduate life, but it was quite different. These are very dangerous animals, and you can't get a babysitter for something that could potentially kill the babysitter. So I was with this animal all the time. So what we were asking was whether all aspects of human language could be entirely teachable or learnable from environmental input, or whether key aspects of human language would resist instruction and thereby teach us whether those essential elements of human cognition and language organization that are unique to our species. Okay, so this is about to end. And so what did we find? What we found was that while these projects are quite controversial, all research projects agree, all parties agree that chimpanzees fail to master key aspects of human language grammar. That is uncontroversial and unarguable. And I was fascinated in this. I found this a very exciting finding. Why is this so? Aspects of the chimpanzee's cognition and linguistic use were actually quite sophisticated. Where was the mismatch? Why did it fall down? Well, the answer to the why, when I turned to the field, was as follows. It was argued, as it is now, that the reason the chimpanzee failed to produce human-like language is because they couldn't actually speak like we do. Well, I found that to be a puzzling reason, a puzzling answer. It can't be, because we gave the chimpanzee sign languages, the natural languages of deaf people. These languages are real languages and are on their hands. So this was a way to bypass the vocal tract, to sort of like trick the brain, to get in via another route, to get into the brain's language capacity centers through the hands. If this animal had the capacity to express language, it should have outed itself. We gave it that key, yet it still failed to master key aspects of human language grammar. This raised the hypothesis to me that human beings had something in addition up there, something from the neck up, in addition to our capacity for speaking. However, when I turned to the field, what did I find? The prevailing view is that speech and sound are absolutely critical, and they're critical in the following key ways. First, it said that the maturation of the capacity to hear in the young infant and the maturation of the capacity to speak in the young infant literally determines the course of language acquisition that we see. The key milestones that we see are ostensibly derived from the child's emerging capacity to move their lips and to hear the sounds. The other thing that it was ostensibly determining is that the early language structures that we see in acquisition, for example, ba, 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 and babbling, are literally determined by the child's moment of getting control of the whole motor strip for oral facial movement. Well, I found that very interesting. Again, sign languages presented this tantalizing test case. This is a way to get into the brain, but to bypass speaking. Another way in which speech and sound was said to be critical is if you turn to adult cerebral organization for language. Here, cortical tissue for language, because and as it's organized in the left hemisphere, was said to be literally determined by the neural pathways for hearing and for the control of speaking. All right? So I had reasons to be suspicious of this. Again, my work with Nim Chimpsky raised doubts for me. Why is it that this chimp couldn't fail to have language? We gave him a silent language, and yet he still didn't out it. So I turned to the study of sign languages as a test case. sign language, just to make sure we're all at the same point, sign languages are not invented. A hearing person did not sit down and invent them. They're naturally evolving, thousands of years old. There's very serious scholarly evidence now that sign languages had to have co-evolved with the evolution of the control of the orofacial region. This is, and we also have very solid evidence that a manual signaling type of communication existed prior to the onset of the capacity to support speech in the species as we know it now. So these languages are thousands of years old, non-invented, and there's a different sign language used in each country. So the people in Britain who use a sign language and the people in the United States who use a sign language, they need an interpreter to understand each other. So this is also an example of where sign language is not the signed counterpart of the spoken majority language, because the spoken majority language in England and in the U.S. is English. Yet the structures of these languages are not just yoked to the structure of the majority language. Yes?
Can you tell a bit more about the structure of the languages and the spatial? I'm still struggling. How the grammar...
Okay, this is something that will take about 10 years. I'll have to describe that more in the discussion period, but these languages use space. Sorry. The aspects of the grammar are set up in space, and aspects of the grammar are also in minute changes of movement. So modulations on verbs, modulations on classes of grammatical categories are done by minute changes of movement, and modulations and other syntactic marking is done by setting up markers in space. These are highly inflected languages. I'll be happy to talk. It was almost as if you said to me, could you please tell me about the grammar of Russian? They're very complex languages, so I can tell you that there are highly inflected languages like Serbo-Croatian, Hebrew, Chinese. Interestingly, the Russian aspect system is a very complex system on the passage of time, and sign languages have extremely complex aspect system, analogous only to Russian, that as we know. So these are very complex grammars. They're a Navajo Indian language. They're highly inflected. They're called synthetic languages as opposed to analytic languages. Analytic rely more heavily on word order. Okay, so why might these sign languages be a test case? Please stay with me on this one. If you have a theory that says all of human language is the way we see it, the way we know it to be, the reason why we see the milestones to be occurring on the developmental timetable that we see, and the reason that we see the structures emerging that we see, is because it is literally due to the development of the control of the motor mouth movements and the ability to hear. So let's just take the motor mouth movements for a moment. I could have taken perception, I'm going to take production. Let's look, this is the primary motor strip. This is where the major control centers for the brain are for the parts of the human body. Along the primary motor strip, around this area right here, this would be, this is the back of the head, this is the front, this is the side of your head. Right here, across the top of your brain, is the primary motor strip. And right around here, we know that that's the control of the lips. That's the neuroanatomical site for the control of the orofacial region that allows you to move your mouth. Now, up the cortex here, distinctly represented, again, this is uncontroversial and a neuroanatomical fact, distinctly represented are the control of the hands. So the control of the lips and the control of the hands are in two discrete centers. I'm not saying there are no mutual projections, but all parties agree that neuroanatomically, the control of the lips and the control of the hands are distinct. So if you have a theory that says all of human language acquisition, particularly the expression of the milestones, are occurring on a maturational timetable because that's reflecting the growth of the control of the orofacial region, what if I strip the brain of the mouth? What if I take it away? And I only give the brain the hands? What would be be the prediction if we compared children exposed to sign language and children exposed to speech? If all of human language is maturing on its timetable, ostensibly because it's being driven by the development of the control of the mouth movements, and I stripped the child of that and instead gave it the hands located at a different tissue, what would the prediction be about a child exposed to sign language? Should the maturation of milestones be the same or different? Based on a theory that says human language acquisition is the way you see it because it's driven by the development of the motor control of speech, and in addition, the perception of sound. What would be the prediction if I stripped the brain of speech and I only gave it the hands? The math's not involved anymore. So should acquisition be the same or different?
Different.
Yes. Okay, so now you'll understand the rest of the talk. Okay. So what did I do? I compared in the early 80s, for about 10 years, I set out to understand that. I took deaf children exposed to sign languages and hearing children exposed to spoken languages. And I did it in two different countries. So I did the United States and Canada. So I had French children acquiring French. I had English children acquiring English. I had American Sign Language children in the United States acquiring ASL. I had French deaf children in Canada acquiring long synchobic quas, which are different. Remember, and again, LSQ is different from the sign language in France. So I had two different modalities, four different languages across two different countries. And what did I find? One of the most surprising things is we found that children exposed to sign language and children exposed to speech achieved each and every milestone on the identical timetable. This really was surprising. This is not what the theories predicted. All right, we found that all normally developing children by about age 10 months had begun babbling. That's ba, 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 da, 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 if they were exposed to speech. However, if they were exposed to sign language, all normally developing children began babbling on their hands. Okay. By 12 months, all normally developing children produce their first word if exposed to words, and they produce their first signs if exposed to signs. By 18 months, all normally developing children produce their first two words or first two signs, depending on the language they were exposed to. And by 24 months, they began the morphological and syntactic embellishments that are known to occur at this period. Does anybody remember what's one of the classic moments of development that are known to occur at this period, about 24 months? Think Steve Pinker. Over-regularizations. So children say, "I goad," even though that's not possible to say. We don't say this in English. They over-regularize based on "I skipped," "I jumped." They'll say, "I goad." All right? So we see this not only in children exposed to spoken language, but it also we saw it in children exposed to sign language, again, on the identical maturational timetable. All during this period, the semantic development is as rich and varied and in the same sequence of semantic development that we see in children exposed to speech, and also all during this period, children exposed to sign language and children exposed to speech are following the identical parallel developments in pragmatic and discourse knowledge. We did not see differences. This is surprising. It suggests that a theory that is proposing that human language is exclusively driven by the capacity, the maturation of the capacity to speak or to hear, needs to be revisited. Okay. Yes.
What's the pragmatics and discourse?
Pragmatics means the how language is used, the illocutionary force of a language. If I how I impact, I can say to you, "I'll do it," or I can say to you, "I'll do it." Okay. So in one way, I'm being very excited about doing it. Another way, I'm doing it. I'll do it, but I'll do it begrudgingly. And there, the syntactic frame is identical, and the only thing that changed is the way in which I used it, and I did that through prosody.
And then finally, language you can express most of your thoughts?
Exactly. In addition, discourse is the structure of a conversation, how you take turns, how you give up the floor, how you change a topic, and how you take the floor. The various, all of this was identical through the courses of development. Good question. And this was puzzling. This was not supposed to be. So I turned to studying, to take, having to another lens, having established that the identical timetable was being followed, whether exposed to hand language or tongue languages, I then took the beacon and began to shine it in more closely at the earlier milestones. It's not just that the timetable is the same, but how tight a fit is this? How close are we? Also, is there something different about these children? Maybe we should look at another population. So I looked at an interesting population. These are hearing children. They're entirely normally hearing children. And they're hearing children who were bilingual, but they're exposed to sign language and spoken language. Here we have, let's say, a deaf mother and a hearing father, or vice versa. These are children who are getting two languages, but one's in one modality and one's in another modality. Two different modalities at the same time. And they were compared to children acquiring hearing, two spoken languages. So both groups were hearing, but one group was getting an extraordinary population. One group of children were getting two languages, but in different modalities. And what did we find? What we found is that the milestones in children who were exposed to speech and sign were being achieved at the same time. Well, this was extraordinary. Why didn't the brain favor speech? Why did these little children who popped out of the womb in their mom's arms, why didn't these children glean the environment for any morsel of sound they can get? Remember the speech theories. If human language is phylogenetically privileged for speech, if human language is neurologically privileged for speech, why didn't those children turn from any morsel of sign they get and turn to sound? Why didn't they gobble up sound? Why didn't we see an asynchrony, a timing difference in their ability to achieve the milestones in speech and sign? We didn't. It was time luck. The brain did not care. It took the hand that was getting the hand, it took the tongue if it was getting the tongue, and it reached each and every milestone on the same timetable. This is also true for the bilingual controls. This is a very important finding in the field of bilingualism, because early bilinguals were said to be delayed and confused. Don't give a child two languages too early. If you give it too early, there'll be a jack of all trades, ace of none. Yes.
I assume most other people don't have any feelings for the phenomena. When a child both hears and signs, a young child, one or a two-year-old, how often do they do it together? So, like, you know, say the word and sign at the same time,
okay,
as opposed to being able to restrict themselves to one code depending on whom they're communicating.
Oh, that's, yes. This is a fascinating question, because it the two modalities does afford the child an option that is not in spoken language. The children mix actually in a restricted and patterned way. There's only so much the processing they can tolerate overlap. So they might sign one or two signs simultaneously with speaking, but after that it falls off and one modality lets go and the other one takes off. They can't stay in two languages at the same time. So for high frequency words high frequency words like eat or go, they can go eat or go. But once they're in full syntactic sentences, they have to stay in one or the other language. So simultaneity is not possible, even though the brain gives it that possibility, even though the modality difference gives it the possibility. It seems that the brain turns away from it. It can't tolerate it. And we've done in the Journal of Child Language article, there's very careful analyses of just how much the child the system can tolerate simultaneity, and it's very, very attenuated, and it falls over very specific parts of speech, and they never do something where they sign one thing and say another. There's always a concur. Yes.
Is there the same brain area that's kind of recruited for that communicative purpose?
Yeah, that's a great question. Is it the same brain area? In my scanning studies, we're finding that yes, if you had early exposure, if you had, actually the brain's quite unforgiving, exposure has to be under age 4 to use exactly the same neural roots. This is what we're finding. Then we have a gray area between 4 and 7. After age 7, if you're exposed to another language, you can be proficient in it, communicatively proficient, but your brain uses different neural roots. In fact, you use more bilateral representation and very, very much more frontal activation. That's a good question. It depends. Neural organization for bilinguals depends on the age of which they, at which they were exposed to the two languages. Yes?
During your study, were there equal numbers of children who had a deaf mother and a speaking father, or a deaf father and a speaking mother?
Yes, that's a good question. Yes, absolutely. We were very sensitive to that, because what if we were getting some social factor, like what if all the mothers were signing and all the fathers were speaking, or vice versa? No, they were definitely equal. Okay, so then I had, I'll give you an example. You'll see this is one child.
Simone is almost 2 years old.
He's signing.
Later.
And he's speaking.
Are we? I don't know.
His mother is profoundly deaf and signs to him. His father is partially deaf and speaks to him in French. Simone, who has normal hearing, seems perfectly comfortable with this arrangement.
Okay, so that was just an example of these children. They develop normally. They're on all factors, cognitively, linguistically, socially, emotionally. Actually, there's cognitive enhancement for bilinguals, which is another story. They actually do perform consistently better on a whole variety of cognitive tasks. This is not just these kids, but all bilinguals. Okay, so now we turn, having seen this, we turn to an extraordinary population of children. This is a very rare population of children. These are hearing children, but they have not been exposed to spoken language input in early life under age 3. And I really mean this. No systematic exposure to spoken language whatsoever. They have been raised exclusively in sign language. All right? Now, let's go back to these theories about the primacy of the speech maturation capacities. Human language ostensibly is shows us the maturational sequence that we see. Why? Because it's supposed to reflect the course of the development of the oral facial region and the capacity to segment speech sounds. These children have had that stripped away from them. How should their human language acquisition be? They're only exposed to hand languages. The same or different? Yeah, different. No, you're right. That's the answer. But I'm trying to link for us the predictions and wed that with testable questions and hypotheses. Okay, so these children are very rare. They're hearing infants exposed exclusively to sign languages, no systematic spoken language input in early life. I had two extraordinary populations. One group of children were hearing children getting either American Sign Language and separately, or langue québécois. Another group of bilinguals, if you could believe it. They were getting ASL and LSQ. Two sign languages, but no spoken language input. Okay, mother is ASL, was a Gallaudet student in Washington, D.C. Father was a student who came down on a student from Quebec on a exchange student. He was a foreign student at Gallaudet University. Falls in love with mom. They go back to Canada. They live there. All right. So two deaf people, two different sign languages, and we have vice versa. We have a family from Alberta where the father is ASL, and a woman from Quebec where the mother's LSQ. And this goes on and on. What did we find? These children hit every single milestone on the identical timetable, but in sign language. All right? This is an example of what we have of the number of months. The red bar is the ASL children. The yellow bar is the LSQ children. Again, these are monolingual children getting only sign language, but they're hearing. The next group of children were the hearing children getting two sign languages from birth, but no spoken language language input. On the left, we have the red is ASL, and then we have the yellow is LSQ. 10 months was the mean for that group, and the ASL, and then 11 months ASL and LSQ. All right, so what we have, these data that I showed you just now, were inconsistent with the hypothesis that the brain was set neurologically for speech or sound. And that's what's key about human language, and that's what's turning human language on. The brain is not set neurologically for speech or sound at birth. The maturation of the speech perception and speech production mechanisms does not determine the time course and sequence of early language acquisition. Finally, speech input is not critical. Well, this is extraordinary. If it's not critical, then what is? All right. So then I turned to try to understand this more carefully. What is? So I decided to take the beacon and now move even closer, down farther to early language. So I turned my studies to the beginning of human language acquisition. And this is, I have to be clear, I'm talking about production now. We all know that children can perceive certain contours, phonetic contours, in utero. So I'm not talking about perception, but the beginning of the expression of language has universally been thought to be babbling, that somehow babbling is intimately linked to the production of language, and it's a goal, it's on the trajectory of language. Now, what is interesting about babbling is that it's regarded as a universal bastion of speech production and sound production. So it is understood as a behavior that reflects the maturation of the oral facial region, and it occurs on the timetable that we see it, because that's the moment when the larynx hooks up to the back of the nasal passage and the child then gets the capacity to produce the sounds. The jaw drops, air comes out, and you get the flapping of the jaw. Ba, 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 da, da, da. So the explanation for babbling in our species has been that it is the moment when there's the neuroanatomical and neurophysiological moment when those systems come together that to produce the child to control the mouth movements to make the sound. So I began to be interested in this, and I began looking at young children who were exposed to sign language, and I compared them with young children exposed to speech, and I just looked at their hand movements and the types of communications they made with their hands. And what we found is that there's certain things that young babies do around 6 months to 9 months with their hands that all babies do. And that's, you know, banging the table or raising their arms to be picked up, or around 9 months, the real communicative instrumental point. Okay, but then there were a set of behaviors that we saw only in children exposed to sign language. And this is a discovery that was reported in Science in 1991 with my graduate student Paula Marinchet. And what we found is that babies who were exposed to sign language produced a small set of meaningless units that happened to be part of the phonetic inventory of natural sign languages that were produced in rhythmic, syllabic ways, and that had no meaning or reference. By all accounts, the babies were literally babbling. The reason that this was such an extraordinary finding is that it challenged the notions about the origins of the capacity to babble. It showed that the neuroanatomical and neurophysiological developments of the motor control of speech production were not necessary for babbling. So that was a surprise. How could it be that you strip away the mouth and you give the brain the hands, and nonetheless out pops babbling on the hands? Just very briefly, let me tell you, the human vocal apparatus has the capacity to make hundreds of sounds. Interestingly, that's a biological capacity. Interestingly, all natural language doesn't take that capacity, only draws a restricted set of sounds. Human languages draw from a highly restricted set of that biological capacity. We produce somewhere, and English produces somewhere around 45 main sound primes. That's a fascinating fact. It turns out, in sign languages, the human brain has been presented with two external articulators. Rather than having one tongue in an internal cavity, now the brain is getting two hands. And the mathematical, the combinatorial possibilities are potentially infinite. But a fact of the structure of world languages, and this will tell you a little bit about the phonology, is that all phonological systems of sign languages draw from a highly restricted set of about 45 hand primes. Amazing convergence of linguistic structure that the brain is outing, pushing itself out on the tongue, pushing itself up out on the hands. So when I tell you that this is babbling, like a human hearing baby who takes sounds from the ambient language and combines them to say ba ba ba, so human babies don't pull out sounds that aren't part of a linguistic system. They don't unless they were click and pop languages, but they don't pull out sounds, they pull out phonetic units. Similarly, deaf babies don't pull out all hand gestures, they only pull out the restricted set of phonetic units that the human natural sign languages are constructed from. So let me give you an example of one of these babies. You're now going to see a 9-month-old, profoundly deaf baby. This is fourth generation deaf baby, deaf mother, father, aunts, uncles, cousins, grandparents, great-grandparents, fourth generation. The entire family's deaf. The sister, the 2.5-year-old sister, is going to be sort of on your left here. I'm off camera signing with the dad. We're lost in a conversation. The baby watches us. Notice the baby's eyes. The baby's going to, very intense, 9 months old, going to look from, just go back and forth. Finally, because the baby's sort of left out of the communicative act, the baby's going to raise his hands, crossing our sight line, and go into the babbling unit. This is a meaningless form. It doesn't signify anything. Yes?
Is there any relationship to baby's development to motor control of hands? Like, because to speak something by hand, it's very articulate movement.
Yes.
So is there any relationship of their control of motor hand movement?
Yes and no. It's a great question. The babies are able to produce certain hand shapes in sign languages that they wouldn't normally produce in the use of hands in the everyday gestural world. So there's an interesting difference there. But having said that, young signing babies go through remarkably similar stages of phonological development on the hands and do very systematic phonological substitutions on the hands that you see in hearing babies who substitute difficult phonetic target sounds for more common, easier phonetic sounds. Okay? So, but the tantalizing observation here is that some of these babies produce things on the hands that an everyday hearing baby would not be able to produce. Okay? So let me show you these babies. Well, one of the things I didn't tell you that you're going to see is that, interestingly, the deaf mother is going to see the baby doing this and actually say to the baby, talk, 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 you mean nothing. Interesting, all moms realize that babbling is gibberish and the baby's trying to communicate but doesn't quite have the words yet. So there you go. I'll try to explain this to you. This is Vance, a little... He's 9 months old. Mom's over here. This is baby. So she's going to imitate him in a moment. I'll show you that moment. So he's looking at us. The eye gaze is going to go ahead and bow back to mom. Dad and me are off over here. He's watching. Now, there he is. He's in it. That's it. He's still doing it. Still doing it. Now, talk, 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 you mean nothing. Now, this sister's going to imitate him. Then he's still doing it, because we're still signing. Now, she does it. You see her? Now, she says, leave him alone. He's learning language. And she's doing it again. Okay. So. All right, so having seen that, one of the things... Oh, here's another example.
...makes the sign for angry. And for curly, notice the hand shape, an open hand with curved fingers, the same as Isabel's, and the movement, a kind of flapping at the wrist.
So that's another syllabic form. The same way you have ba-ba-ba type kids, there's da-da-da type kids and ka-ka-ka. Kids get a preferred phonetic syllable and stick with it. There's one form of babbling is like this, another form is like this. It reflects the syllabic structure of the languages. And that was just a little piece to show you the derivation, where these phonetic units could come from and the ambient signs that they're seeing around them. Okay, so having seen that, it challenged these prevailing hypotheses. One is that babbling was the result of a rhythmic oscillations between an open and closed configuration of the vocal tract accompanied by phonation, oscillations of the mandible. Yes, I'd say yes, this has to do with rhythmic oscillations, but no to oscillations of the mandible. And it suggested a new hypothesis. Whatever mechanism is working in the human brain over the tongue is also working over the hands, and it can't be deeply speech-based per se. There must be some supramodal sensitivity that the brain has to aspects of the patterning of the language. Whatever this is, it's something that could detect the structural invariances across something as radically different as patterns on the mouth or patterns on the hands, and nonetheless perceive the structural invariances across these two radically different modalities and still find the patterns of natural language. It suggested that human language acquisition was starting with a sensitivity to certain patterns, and the brain was going to entertain it, whether it was patterns on the hands or patterns on the tongue. Now, what was key was the presence of the patterns, and what was not key was the presence of sound alone. Yes?
So what's the mandible?
I'm sorry. The mandible is a jaw. So it's oscillations of the jaw. I'm so sorry. Of the jaw. Like this. Ba, 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 da, da, da. Okay, so it suggested that there was some mechanism that was perhaps sensitivity to rhythmic oscillations. This was looking for mechanisms that are biologically true and plausible of the brain. So whenever you propose theories or hypotheses, you have to make sure they're constrained by being true of the brain. So this is very important in your own work and theorizing. When you have a hypothesis and you want to say is X true, it has to be potentially true of the way the brain works. The other thing was how to study it. Finally, I had to figure out what was its biological basis. So, how on earth was I supposed to study rhythmic oscillations, particularly if it was some sensitivity to rhythmic oscillations across the hands and the tongue? Well, I just happened to have a great colleague at in Montreal who had done some work looking at the oscillations of the vocal apparatus when a child is producing vocalizations, and was using at the time a wet spot system, and we turned to an optotrack system. And this is a system where you put light emitting diodes on someone's hands or on the oral facial region, light emitting diodes, and the person goes about their normal movements. Camera sensors in the ceiling pick up where the LEDs are, and then a computer program gives you computations that actually tell you the trajectory of movement, the rate of the movement, the velocity of the movement. Essentially, is a speech spectrogram, but for motor activities, for sign language. So that's what we had at McGill University. This is a paper that was reported in Nature last year with my graduate student, Siobhan Holoka, Lauren, Sergio, and David Ostry. We were asking what were the biological bases of human babbling. Was it just motor control, the maturation of ability to talk, or was it linguistic patterns? Did the brain have some sensitivity to linguistic patterns? Okay, these patterns are interpreted as rhythmic patterns that bind syllables. Was there some sensitivity that the child had to the rhythmic undulating patterns that we produce that bind syllables even when we're producing language? Okay, so how is I going to do this? We use optotrack technology. We had two groups. This is very important. We had those hearing children who were exposed to speech and the hearing children who were exposed only to sign language. Why are these an interesting group? Both groups are normally developing. There is no neural compensation to the brain. There's no taking away of one sense and another one having to be. The only thing that differed was the modality, was their language, and in particular the modality of the language different. The modality different. We put LEDs on the hands and feet. We exposed the children to multiple contexts. What are the predictions? If the motor theory is correct, if human language is being determined by the rate and development of the orofacial region to produce sounds, then the two groups of children should not differ, because language is ostensibly coming, being its executive command is coming from the development of the mouth motor movements. The hands are not the mouth. So the two groups of children should produce rhythmic movements on their hands, very similar. But if something about human language involved the sensitivity to aspects of the patterning of language, and whether patterning was on the hands or the tongue, we should see differences in the groups. Okay, so what did we do? Thank you. Okay, so there's an example of a six-month-old. Baby, no speech, systematic spoken language input to this child. Hears environmental sounds and grunts from the mother, like a mother laughing. This baby's babbling. There's the light-emitting diode. I must tell you, we did not see the babies in the data analysis stage. It's very important that you know this. What we saw only were these. This is the readings that we would see. We were initially blind to whether we were looking at a hearing baby who was gesturing, or a hearing baby exposed to speech who was gesturing, or a hearing baby exposed to sign. Here is what we all, that's the only information that we were given, and the computations that came out of this were the follows. The data told us that there were two groups of children. One group of children produced fast movements. These were three complete movement cycles per second, and they only produced that. Another group of children produced two types of movements. They produced the fast movements, the three complete movement cycles per second, but in addition, they produced another type of hand activity. These were slower hand activity. Let me see if I can show you this visually. The first group, the hearing children, they're all hearing, the first group produced three complete movement cycles per second. The second group produced two types of activity. One was 2.5 to 3 movement cycles per second, and the other one was 1 hertz per second. When we stripped of the blind, we found that the kids who were making the two types of movement were, guess who? The signers, the children exposed to sign language. We also found that the children exposed to sign language, when they were making the slow movements, were indeed producing the rhythmic manual movements of manual babbling. So this was exciting. What would it give the child to be sensitive to rhythmic patterns with maximal contrast of approximately 1 hertz? What would it give the human child if they had that sensitivity? I should also say that in early babbling, this repetitive production and sensitivity to this temporal envelope is about the size of a word. Okay? What would it give the child? I want you to pay attention.
A baby's perspective, they have the same problem that you or I might have if we were to go to Russia, for example, and speak to someone.
What we hear is a continuous stream of sound. Бабушка в Молдавии. Я сильно удивилась, что
it's very difficult for us to find the beginning or end of the words because we don't know the language, so we can't segment the stream.
Обождем местного индейского племени.
Okay, so the point is that if you don't, you know Russian, but if you don't know Russian, it's the problem facing the young baby who pops out of the womb, and the problem facing us as adults is we don't know where the beginnings or ends of the words are. So how does a baby find it? If a baby had a sensitivity to the rhythmic underlying patterns in the input of about a second and a half, they can parse the stream. They can find in this continuous stream the bite-sized nuggets that allows them to pull out the phonetic segments and then perform the distribution of implicit frequency analyses that will give them the set of sounds in the native language from which the whole language will form. It also would allow them to find the word. A child cannot begin to solve the problem of reference unless they can find the word. It allows the child to find the word. So,
I have a question.
Yes.
I don't quite understand how just 1 hertz
frequency will be applied to every language and will allow the child to parse the...
This is the initial window of sensitivity that a baby is born with that changes over the first 6 months of life. This window gets longer and longer, and by 6 months, it's actually the size of a phrase. Okay.
So within one third, they detect
It's the rhythmic burst of about it's a sensitivity to a timing window of about a hertz a second long that allows them to figure ground. It's an attentional mechanism that allows them to pull forward certain salient chunks and to background others. But it's changing over the first year. It doesn't stay at one hertz. Yes.
I guess I'm a little unclear about what a rhythm of a speech would be versus the velocity of a speech. It's not velocity, correct? It's not speed.
That's right. It's not speed. They're maximally contracted. They alternate. Think of a syllable. It's a maximally open, maximally closed, maximally open, maximally closed unit that is in constant alternation. And interestingly, it's the same unit that's on the hand.
Does that vary by language?
No. Even in Moraic languages, all languages have, as a linguist, it varies in your description of target languages differ. You have Moraic languages, you have Cathartic languages, you have stress time languages, Italian is a stress time language. You have different types of characterizations, but for the perceptual system, let's take away our characterization of it, the perceptual system has a sensitivity to a temporal window of about a second long. Okay. I'm just going to move on so we can... I want to just... Oh, yes, okay.
I don't have any questions for later, but I'm just curious about the developmental milestones of a deaf child that's born to hearing parents who is not exposed to sign language right away and can't understand speech language. So they receive...
It's a great question. The question was, what happens to a child who is the hearing child who's only exposed to sign language, right?
No, that's true. That's how important to hearing parents.
Oh.
Sign language, right? Like, they realize the child is deaf, but they have to then learn sign language to...
Okay, it depends on the age at which this is discovered and they are put into some type of remediation program. It also depends on whether the age and the remediation program and what it is, if it's a strictly oralism or strictly sign. Okay. The best case scenario is the child should be discovered early, and it literally depends on the level of deafness. Profoundly deaf children, some benefit from sign exposure, some benefit from bilingual exposure, and some benefit from oral exposure, and it depends on the degree of deafness in the individual child. We can talk more about that in the discussion. Okay, so let me just ask this question. Having seen that this capacity is, there's a sensitivity, this presented a puzzle to the field. How could there be a sensitivity when ostensibly the brain's neural circuitry for human language is not even set until... And here's where we get into controversy. Some researchers say that's not set until 4 years old. Other researchers say it's not set until 7. Other researchers say lateralization, the part that means the tissue in the human brain that's going to take on the job of language processing, is already set in the brain at birth. How could this be? When is this capacity coming online? So I was inspired by studies over the years, and here's what I found. One of the things that's interesting is that Michael Gazzanica and Charlotte Smiley in 1983 found, guess what? We smile mostly out of the left side of our mouth. Now, I should just tell you that these asymmetries I'm going to tell you may sound odd, but we do it. Why don't you see me as smiling mostly out of the left side of my mouth and talking mostly out of the right side of my mouth? Do you know why?
compensate?
Yes, we compensate. You're right. The human visual system loves symmetry. It's very deep. It has to do with art. And the human visual system fixes it. Okay, but I can tell you how to unfix it. Go to your bathroom mirror tonight. Take your handheld mirror. Hold it up to your nose like this and turn it slightly at an angle. Start talking. You will now break the illusion and you will see how asymmetric your face is when you speak. In fact, it's quite alarming. Then take it away, and you're not going to believe this. You will see yourself as being symmetrical again, even though you know you have knowledge. It's not true. Your visual, it's such a powerful illusion. Your brain will fix it. Okay. So just let me to go on. Graves and Landis in 1990 found that adults talk out of the right side of their mouth. So this implicates the right hemisphere for emotional control with smiling, and conversely, the left hemisphere in the mediation of linguistic processes when we speak. Now, this is a very interesting thing because Graves and Landis actually found a remarkable discovery. They were able to invent this this laterality index, which computes the degree of asymmetry of a person. And it's used as a bedside test in triage in a hospital when someone comes in after a motorcycle accident or any kind of head injury or stroke to get a very rough and ready way to see how much of left and right brain tissue was spared. A doctor, attending a physician, will administer the laterality index to just get a sense of how much left and right brain damage there was. Okay, so we're going to use this laterality index in a moment. In 1990, my graduate student Paula and I found that the baby hand babbling in deaf babies was predominantly with the right hand, indicating left-hand control as early as 6 months. And then in Holoka and Petito in 2002, this is a paper that just came out in Science a couple of months ago, we are going to return to this question. And the question is, what about baby vocal babbling? Just everyday baby babbling. Is there any asymmetry? Because if it's a fundamentally linguistic act, babbling, and not a general motoric act, then babies really might babble more out of the right side of their mouth. But if babbling is, as the field has said, just the motor control, then vocalizations, everything, babbling, non-babbling, anything that's a vocalization should come out of the mouth equally, not showing any asymmetry. So what did we find? We found that babies from 5 months old use their mouth differently. I'll show you this in a moment. We found that babies begin babbling primarily out of the right side of their mouth, implicating the left hemisphere. When they're not babbling, but producing a vocalization, it comes out of the mouth equally. And when they're smiling, there's a greater mouth aperture opening on the left side. In fact, this was the earliest demonstration from physiological measures that the baby's right hemisphere emotional control centers were online. So when a baby smiles, you know, this whole controversy, is it a real smile? Is it a socially conditioned behavior that's imparted from the environmental input, or is it an endogenous expression of pleasure, and is it mediated by emotional centers? Well, it turns out, yes, we think it is.
How about pitch matching, tone matching in infants? If I go, and the child comes back. Have you looked at the
No, I haven't. But that's a very interesting thing. Because we're getting new technology now with NERS, that is a hemodynamic measurement of neural tissue activity that we are moving to. So we'll do this. Okay. Yes.
This is fascinating. Because, as you know, perhaps we were working here at Harvard with Gordon and many others with half-brain children.
Ah, yes.
And the last one had his left hemisphere removed when he was 10. He's now
11. 10 years old.
Yeah. And he lost his speech.
Yes.
And I remarked that he spoke with his right mouth.
Interesting.
And,
yes, because the...
Sorry.
Yes.
perhaps I made a very crucial mistake. I was amazed because he was so asymmetrical in his speaking.
Yeah.
But he's speaking always with his left.
Which indicates that aspects of the right hemisphere might have performed compensatory functions.
Oh, this is amazing, and thank you very much.
Actually, some of Michael Gazanica and Charlotte Smiley made their original discoveries with split brain patients who had the corpus callosum severed. So there's a somewhat of a connection. Okay, let me just show you this. Just give you a sense. Just to give you what this means, when we saw right hand use with the hand babbling and right mouth primarily use with the with vocal babbling, it showed us that the same laterality, the same left hemisphere laterality was at work in the same time course. So this is a baby babbling. You'll see it in slow motion. So that's a vocalization, but it's not a babble. She just had a spaghetti dinner. This is an 11-month-old baby. Okay, and that's non-babble, and this is... That's the smile. I also watched the left eye. It's going to have a greater muscle contraction. And this is interesting. This is what Paul Ekman had actually seen with adults. There's much more of a... Look at the size of the left eye as compared to the right. The whole left side of the face, for all of us actually, is more contracted. Okay, so what I've shown you is that we've seen across modality identical milestones, babbling, and laterality. The brain does not seem to hold the distinction between input from the hands or input from the tongue. It just takes it and goes on its normal maturational timetable, takes it and produces the same babbling, even to the point of having laterality. Initially, this suggested to me that a common mechanism was at work. That whatever it was that was going to be controlling the acquisition of spoken language and whatever it is that was controlling the acquisition of sign language was one and the same mechanism. It's not like nature gives you something for speech and just in case you're deaf, it like puts another mechanism out there. We should see temporal delays in development if there has to be that kind of massive rewiring. We don't see it. But then I moved to a more radical hypothesis. And this hypothesis was the most radical because it now involved the cerebral organization of human language and the basis of the tissue, the neural base of the tissue. I said to myself after 22 years of research that I'm seeing something here. It can't be just the common mechanism. It must be that the same tissue is involved. So I set to, my task to study this. What we did, this is a profoundly deaf person who's about to be put into the brain scanner. Does anyone sign? No? Okay. Actually, this is LSQ. I signed ASL and LSQ. This was done with Robert Sadori, a wonderful colleague of mine at the Montreal Neurological Institute, who, ironically enough, is world-renowned for his work on speech processing. Okay, so this is a great union, right? This is someone who said speech is special. The neural tissue for the human brain is dedicated for speech. Speech tissue is only going to process speech. Hand languages cannot be in this tissue. So this was my... Oh, this is recorded. Right? But I had a happy ending. Oh my God. We won't give him the website. Okay, so what did we do? Let me just let you, let's just look at this. Well, it's all true. Let me just, this is the old view of the neuroanatomy of speech. These are aspects of human language processing that have been literally tied, wed to very specific neurotissue. That'd be quite exciting. Brain is quite specialized for language processing. But I'm going to ask why. All right, so here we do now know that as you're listening to me now and you are segmenting the speech stream and pulling out my phonetic units, we do know absolutely that your superior temporal gyrus is doing the job. Okay, so these are the eyes, this is the back of the head, slice the brain, take out the top right here, look right up the ear, if you touched right here, this is your superior temporal gyrus, and it processes parts of words like pa, pa, ta, okay? And this is the left inferior frontal cortex. We now know that this tissue is responsible for the search and retrieval for the information about words. The controversy is whether or not this is a site for semantic processing, or if this is a site for the search and retrieval of semantic processing. Everybody agrees that the left inferior frontal cortex, if that brain of yours is working, is involved in the search and retrieval of information about words. Now, why do people say this is so? Why? They say this is so because this is the site for the processing of sound. Of course you're going to process pa, ta, da in this tissue. This is, your ear is here. Primary auditory signal is like a bridge, and there's an island, and it dumps its output into tissue here, the secondary auditory cortex. What else could the tissue do but process sound? For 125 years, it has been neuroanatomical dogma. The tissue is the bastion of sound processing. It is unimodal processing. It is for cytoarchitectonic, chemoarchitectonic, and connectivity criteria. The books will tell you this is unimodal processing of sound tissue. It can't do anything else. It's like there's an island and there's no way to get there. It's supposed to be a freestanding unimodal tissue. And this tissue, because it's near Broca's tissue, which is responsible for planning of complex motor movements for speech, is said to be there. So what are they doing? They're wedding the sites, the neural basis of the sites for language processing to the processing of sound. Okay, so I'm going to test that. What did I do? I took profoundly deaf people. Okay, but just let me tell you, I am not interested in where. Pioneering studies by Helen Neville and Ursula Bellucci had already told us that deaf people process sign languages in the left hemisphere and other types of visual spatial processing in the right. The question is not where. We know where sign languages are processed, which is amazing in itself. I really mean pioneering studies by Helen Neville and Ursula Bellucci. My question is why? What is the neural basis for this tissue? What is happening? We see pa, da, ta processed in the superior temporal gyrus. Why? Is it because that's the site of the processing of sound, or is there something about that tissue that's dedicated to processing highly specific patterns that got encoded and pressed through evolutionary mechanisms in sound? Okay, we had six conditions. I'll only tell you about two of them. One condition was meaningless phonetic syllabic units in sign language. They were the equivalent of ba, pa, ta on the hands. They were phonetic syllabic units on the hands. The next condition, they were meaningful signs, like meaningful words. I'm going to give you an example of just this because I know it's very hard to wrap your mind around what these look like. I'm going to show you whether they're possible but non-existing. They're not even signs. They're just like a thing. Ba-ba-ta. Ta-ta-pa-pa. Ka-ma-ta-ta. All right? So here's an example of what... So there were two groups of people. They were hearing people who were never exposed to sign language. So it would be like you if you don't know sign. You're in the scanner. You're going to look at this. What part of your brain's going to become active? Versus profoundly deaf people who were in the scanner and they're seeing this. What part of their brain's going to be active? Okay. So... these don't mean anything. They have the right temporal prosody, the right syllabic structure of a natural sign language, a natural sign. They're like ba ba ta. Okay, so that's an example. What did we find? There were two exciting findings. One, we found that profoundly deaf people, when they were processing hand signs that had meaning like cup and book, etc., they too use their left inferior frontal cortex. This is a stunning convergence of a linguistic function on brain tissue. This is our dream. Everybody, in the last two decades, the decade of the brain, when we wanted, what did we want to know? There's something about higher cognition. Does the brain have specialized jobs? And there's something about this abstract thing we call language that's actually, is there a part of the brain that does it? This is a stunning convergence of a linguistic function on brain tissue. This has now been found with Chinese, with Japanese, with English, with French, and also in natural sign languages. Oh, I didn't tell you that we had two sign languages. This was an independent cross-linguistic design. We had LSQ and ASL deaf people, so that we didn't want to find out something that was peculiar to ASL, because every other study has been done on ASL. Okay, so what, and this is the visual cortex and Vicky's V5, motion and detection analysis that we expected with sign language. Okay, the thing, left inferior frontal cortex. And the thing that's so exciting about this is that this is true even for a non-spoken language. This calls into question the hypothesis that the neural basis of this tissue is just because it happens to be sitting near the Broca's control of the lips. Okay. The most exciting finding for me, however, was we found when a hearing person looked at somebody doing ba ba pa, those things you saw in sign language, there was no activation of the superior temporal gyrus. But when a deaf person looked at these forms that were phonetic units in sign language, phonetic, but it's not based on sound, it's phonetic in structure on the hands, they had, I mean, this is extremely exciting. Superior temporal gyrus activation. Again, this is Zeki's V5. This is motion analysis. This is vision, primary vision. They had superior temporal gyrus activation. Why is this so surprising? These are deaf brains. There is no sound input. This is supposed to be the bastion of sound, unimotor processing. This is the thing that's supposed to be connectivity, chemoarchitectonically, cytoarchitectonically, an autonomous freestanding tissue sound base. Yes.
I want to quarrel a bit with the history you gave.
Okay.
Conceding that you're much closer to this than I. I wasn't there 120 years ago, but I was there 30 or 40 years ago. It seems to me people didn't really think very much about deaf people, and Baluji's work was very important in assimilating deaf to the language analysis. But certainly the teaching was that anything doing with written language, you know, with reading, would echo very closely what you found brain-wise for spoken language. So I think there was a recognition among people who knew something about language in the brain that basically those areas were interested in serving speaking and hearing, but anything having to do with language. And when you hold up, you know, Lieberman, I mean, that was an extreme view on something else. It wasn't what you would do if you talked to a physiologist.
Okay, but I agree with you, but. So, for example, when you read, you can access superior temporal gyrus tissue where you're not actually talking and you're not really hearing sound. All right? There's an example of where, quote, visual information is ostensibly activating aspects of tissue that was thought to be unimodal. However, the only time the activation of the superior temporal gyrus was encountered is if it somehow involved the simultaneous activation of the language. So reading is parasitic on sound. When I read, I'm decoding it from, there's a sound to grapheme correspondence. So I am doing phonological processing when I read. The superior temporal gyrus was not seen to become activated for language, for visual information, unless the visual information involved either the visual decoding of something that does have sound encoded, one, or two, involved the mental representation, the mental imagery of sound. So you actually can get the superior temporal gyrus to be activated without sound by having someone mentally image sound.
But confused.
Yes, yes.
I think I actually have some converging evidence to what you just said.
Okay.
We actually, with Russ Podrick, did a task where we gave a picture to adults, and they had to phonologically say if two pictures start with the same sound or not.
Okay.
So they don't hear sound, but they have to activate sound.
Right.
And this is exactly the same area.
Great. Yes, so that's exactly what... thank you. That's it. That's it. So I just have 5 more minutes and I'm done, and we'll have plenty of time for discussion. Yes.
I just wonder if, and I don't know anything about this, but maybe it was just a question.
No, no.
Speed readers, for example, versus, my sense is that somebody who's speed reading isn't necessarily converting
That's
it
right.
into, you know, they're not saying the words to themselves.
That's right. That's right. The more automatic you become, the less you're dragging in bottom-up, lower-level type analyses. In fact, when you trip up a speed reader, then you can have them to resuscitate that bottom-up level of processing. Yes.
And so do those light up different parts of the brain when you're speed reading versus when you're saying the words to yourself?
Okay. I don't know this literature. This is to you? Yes.
I don't, but I would think that if you don't pronounce the words to yourself, then that James is not actually there.
I agree with you, because we have seen that the goal of the brain is for rapid processing, and you're not supposed to be dragged down to the bottom level. So that's why we fix mistakes. If I said to you, John works for the telephone company, but his paycheck is really bad, in very rapid speech, you wouldn't pick up that I substituted a phonetic unit. Okay, but if I make you attend to it, I could bring you down to that phonological level, because I actually substituted a segment company for company. And you fix that, you smooth that out. You're really not dragged down. A speed reader, I would predict, is not going to be hovering over decoding all the sounds. Although I would predict you'd get some activation. And in fact, I predict you could trip them up. I predict you can design experiments where you'd get more of it and less of it, depending on how much you trip up the phonological code in the messages that they're reading.
So okay. Trip them up, you mean deliberately putting words with the other words?
Right. That require that they come back down and allocate attention to decoding that word. Right. Okay, so very quickly, the findings alter our assumption about the neuroanatomy of language as being tied to speech. They alter our assumptions. Human language processing can't be literally, exclusively coming from the capacity to talk. I'm going to just explain one brief experiment, and I'm done. I think you might have known Norm Geschwin, and this is in memory of Norm Geschwin. What about the neuroanatomy of tissue as being tied to modality? Okay, we know that Norm Geschwin had found that 23% of his patients, but nonetheless, the claim that made it to the general population was that the left hemisphere in the superior temporal gyral region, the planum temporalis, this is the secondary auditory tissue, guess what? It's bigger than on the right side. So left planum is bigger in those of us who speak. This is a famous finding by Norm Geschwin. And why was the received view, why is this so? Well, this is where the brain is doing the lion's share of spoken language analysis, so that's why you massaged in this tissue a little bit more. That's why the tissue would be greater. So I turned to look at this. This is a paper we have submitted to Nature Neuroscience. It's under review. This is a morphometry paper. I just have to tell you this. Follow me along with me here. This is the, again, it's this tissue right here. Right at the tip where your nail would be your planum. You have the green at the planum temporalis. This is secondary auditory tissue. And then it's fed by primary auditory tissue. Primary auditory tissue is like the ear. So it's called Heschel's gyrus, H1, H2, and this is the, just at the juncture, it's called H2, and then we go into the planum, and this is what's doing your Bapata tissue, okay? So what we did is we took 22 brains, okay? Half were hearing, half were deaf. We scrambled the brains together. We then flipped. we just scrambled these brains together, and they were. We took. Oh, that's a really good question. We have. We scanned their brains in an fMRI machine, the functional magnetic resonance imaging. We got pictures of their brains, and what those pictures produced was this, just this, without the little, not without the green and without the H and without the PT. Okay, so this is what the neuroanatomical radar was looking at. Then we literally flipped the X and Y axis, so the neuroanatomical radars didn't have any idea as to whether they were in the right hemisphere or whether they were in the left hemisphere. And what their task was to do volume analyses on all the gray matter and all the white matter in the tissue area that is neuroanatomically identifiable as, you know, these are like regions of the moon, regions of the brain, the superior temporal gyrus, and Heschel's gyrus. What we found was that there was no difference in the in Heschel's gyrus. This is primary auditory tissue. No difference in the white and gray matter. There was no difference in the planum temporale gray matter. And in the deaf people and in the hearing people, the left hemisphere planum was larger than the right hemisphere planum. These are deaf brains. What is going on? Let me just give you, you could just visually look at this. These are the, there was no difference in the location, the extent, and the landscape variability of the location of these primary auditory and secondary auditory tissue. No difference. What does this mean? If there's no difference in the gray matter volumes of the Heschel's gyrus, which is the primary auditory cortex, it means that there was no cell loss. If there's no difference in white matter in your brain for Heschel's gyrus, white matter tells you that there's no loss in the neuronal input from A1 into A2. How could this be? These are deaf brains. Why didn't this sound tissue shrivel up? Why didn't it die? Why? Well, atrophy. We know that the aspects of the visual cortex will atrophy. Why didn't this tissue atrophy? It didn't atrophy because the tissue is getting ongoing language processing. This tissue is not dedicated to sound. It's dedicated to function. It's dedicated to highly specific patterns in the input that correspond to rhythmic undulating bursts of about a second and a half. It's dedicated to a pattern. It's not dedicated to sound. This is probably the most stunning evidence to date that the neural tissue is dedicated to function, not to modality. I want to make clear to you, this is not classic reorganization. This is not like Sir's work at MIT and the ferret brain reorganization. This is not that. This is neural tissue that's doggedly, rigidly taking the same function, even if I strip you of the sense input. We're now doing studies to ask if these are fundamentally at the cellular level, a fundamental polymodal site. These are sort of like hermaphrodite cells that, based on the pattern of the input, set to one modality versus the other. We're also looking about questions of genetic unmasking or genetic sprouting. Maybe there's something about this tissue that could sprout upon need aspects of based on the pattern and the input adaptation to the modality. So how is this possible? We've seen the same milestones, same language structure, same brain tissue. The tissue in the human brain is dedicated to detecting and processing highly specific patterns that are in language. It is not dedicated to sound. I just want to make sure you actually see this. It's very important to me. The species has a lot to offer, and we're not so unimodally dedicated only to sound. What I've shown you today, there were assumptions about the adult brain as being fundamentally the way it is neurally because it's speech organized. Child brains were thought to be fundamentally speech organized. I've shown you PET studies, acquisition studies, studies that show us that sign and speech have the same sites, studies that show us that sign and speech acquisition are on the same time course. This teaches us that the brain has a variety of specialized neural substrates. This is one of them. Think car parts. You open up the hood, there are different car parts. The brain has, it's one of its car parts, are sensitive to highly specific patterns in the input of maximal contrast and of rhythmic bursts of about 1 hertz. So the old view was that human language, sound came in, was literally neurologically privileged, hooked up only to the motor production sites for the control of the orofacial region, based on the time it took to analyze the speech string and map it up to the ability to produce it. That's when this popped out, no way. What I'm telling you is that the human brain has a neural substrate sitting there somewhere in the superior temporal gyrus that's sensitive to highly specific patterns of maximal contrast of about a second long that come into the human brain. By the way, the brain has many special processes. The aspects of the environmental input shunt around the brain, hitting various special processes, and when there's a lock and key engagement, one begins to blossom and go off. Human language is sensitive to the patterns in the input. If the child engages those patterns in the input, the child will then, neurally, there are piggyback cells that sit under this tissue that are already that map the pattern to which they came in. There's pre-existing links to the motor cortex. And based on the modality of language input, the human brain motor strip will bifurcate. If the language came in on the hands, it'll take the hands. If it came in on the tongue, it'll take the tongue. In conclusion, human language is the result of spectacular cortical plasticity and cortical specialization. They go together. It's a biological system that's both open and closed. It's open so that it can handle the environmental vagaries to which it could have been exposed. It's closed and fixed so that it can ensure that it gets to that target state despite the environmental vagaries. Speech is not critical to the human language acquisition process. You know this thing that we hold so near and dear to our hearts, namely speech? Well, it's this thing that we love and hold so near and dear to our hearts is neurologically set after birth, after you come out, after birth. Cortical specialization exists in the brain. There's neural systems that are sensitive to particular distributional patterns relevant to aspects of natural language, regardless of modality. And young babies and children thrive on early experience with language and social interaction, but in particular the rhythmic patterns that we put in language. Thank you all to the people who've helped me in my lab. Thank you to the Spencer Foundation that's heavily funded this research, the Government of Canada, very generous grant from Dartmouth College and my startup funds, and I thank you all. Yes.
How do you think this relates to other pattern recognition capabilities of the brain, say for visual pattern recognition, music, or...
It's a great question. The question was, how do I think this relates to other visual patterns and the other patterns in the capacities of the brain has, like visual pattern recognition? It shares. The brain is redundant in that it's built in our ability to detect patterns. We need it. We need it to figure foreground information to set out others. We do it perceptually. We do it conceptually. We do it right up the stream. At the same time, I would argue very strongly that because it shares that redundancy with the brain in being a pattern recognition mechanism, it doesn't mean it's a general pattern recognition mechanism. It doesn't mean it's general to the human brain. It doesn't mean that a Piagetian type explanation of general cognition, general pattern, could account for all of human language acquisition. It's general in that it is a pattern recognition machine, but it is specific in that its job is set to the specific patterns that are going to be salient to the child achieving this very important function, learning a language and getting into your species very quickly. Yes.
And two other questions. The first is, we can be blind in many different ways, presumably only deaf in one. I mean, are there different ways in which you can be deaf? I mean, is it always the same sort of...
Yes. No. There are different ways in which you can be deaf.
Okay, the second related question...
That's a very important question.
Which...
I only use one kind of deaf person.
Okay, good. Second is related to that is about the kind of ontology of sound in terms of, we think of it as vibrations, wave vibrations, and I'm wondering whether a sort of potential really abstract counter-argument to this would be that in the process of sign language we're actually creating vibrations which are a form of sound even if not the conventional form. I mean, like, well, yeah, simply if I...
Oh, you're right. The rheumatistic, in fact, a baby in the stomach of a deaf mother should have access to those prosodic undulations of the structure of the language through the way in which she moves her hands that temporally encase phrases in sign language in the same way the uterine wall acts as a low-pass filter, and at 6 months, a baby in utero can actually hear, what is it hear? The prosodic undulations of the sound around them. And what's it pulling out? Time, temporal patterning. So a baby in utero, in a signing mom, should be able to have access to the same type of temporal information, even though it's coming in on a different modality.
Presumably, as well, these undulations can be extremely subtle. I mean, so subtle that we know when we have hearing tests, there are certain signs which we can't actually hear even if we have perfect hearing.
Right.
And I wonder whether that gets so subtle that it becomes something like sound just in the rhythmaticity of hand movements. Whether that could be seen as a form of sound which is detectable as sound rather than detectable as vision. Or is that going too far? I don't know.
I'm so sorry. Can you...
Well, when we typically think of sign language as something visual. You're communicating by visual means. But I'm wondering whether it's conceivable that part of the communication is also through sound in the sense of creating certain vibrations which are picked up by the nervous system in some way.
Yes. I see what you're saying. This is a very deep question because it has to do with where would that rhythmic nucleus come from anyway? And yes, people through in other fields who've like in looking at language evolution have hypothesized that that rhythmic sensitivity might even come from the heartbeat. Apropos of that, why might the brain have evolved tissue that's sensitive to abstract patterns? Why wouldn't the brain have developed tissue that's utterly yoked to the modality of the input? I could think up reasons why, and it involves what we know about the facts of phylogenetic history. This thing that I'm doing now, that we hold so near and dear to our heart, in its oldest estimates, is only 70,000 years old. The more average estimate is about 40,000 years old. Now, consider. I won't even go back to Homo sapiens. When was the spectacular flourishing of cave art that had sequences? When was that? 100,000 years ago.
No.
Yes.
No.
What?
Lascaux was like 30,000 years ago. There was nothing 100,000.
100,000 years ago, Homo sapiens sapiens traveled in packs, wore loincloths, buried their dead with symbols, had coordinated hunts, had fires, and had cave and scribbled, like had... Okay, let's leave art out. Let's leave the fact that we know they had coordinated hunts. We know that they wore protective clothing on their genitalia. We know that they had they traveled in packs, and we know that they took shelter as groups. If the human speech apparatus, in its oldest aging, is only 70,000 years old, what were those people doing? Were they mute? How were they doing these coordinated things? We know that they vocalized. We know that they had face-to-face contact. And we know that they, by that point, for at least a million years, were walking upright and had use of their hands. So if you have a trilogy, that's all it takes neurally to have bifurcation of a neural system. You have information coming in visual facially, you have spatially, you have information with modulations of the oral facial region, and you have some type of, even if they simply went, even if they simply vocalized with vision and oriented with a hand to the a direction of a food source or a predator, that's enough computationally to need to have brain tissue that can abstract away from the source of the signal and just to pull out meaning very rapidly. Because the conundrum for neuroanatomists is there's a spectacular traversing of brain real estate. The control of the oral facial region, I'm sorry, let me step back. The control of the vocalizations is of the emotional grunts that we share with other animals and that we make is in the diencephalon midbrain. The conundrum for neuroanatomists is how on earth, what were the selection pressures that dragged the control of sound, of vocalizations up and over and up to the lateral part of the left hemisphere? That's the problem. That tissue must have been doing something else that was relevant, that was able to be grabbed and used for this other function. This is work that's been very, actually significantly inspired by Giacomo Rizzolatti. Does anyone know Rizzolatti's work? This is the motor neuron theory, mirror neurons, I'm sorry. What he's found in monkeys that are share with us aspects of the equivalent of Broca's tissue, and they're 10 million year old homologs to Broca's tissue. He's found in the monkey brain, so this is something that could have existed in 10 million years ago, that tissue in the Broca's tissue, homolog F5 of a monkey brain, when it sees you pick up something, it's Broca's tissue 5. When it picks up the something, it's Broca's tissue 5. So it's a mirror neuron. It fires if it does it itself and if you do it. And the idea is that the tissue had already been involved in the interpretation of self versus other acts. In fact, in these mirror neurons, the neural system has to literally stop you from imitating everything you see. And there are receptor cells on the central nervous system on your spinal cord that bind to these cells, these signals, as they come out of your Broca's tissue and actually stop you from reflexively doing everything I do. So the idea is that somewhere in evolution, the control of this system was the origin, the originator of self versus the interpretation of self versus other actions. And that this tissue was actively, and it's highly salient because you have to understand an action that you're doing of sitting and eating an apple that's neutral versus about to attack me. So this tissue that's already at work coordinating your action, my action, having me imitate you, not imitate you, and controlling that could have given rise to a primitive notion of self versus other, that when there was this, and already we're getting a multimodal a tissue that's abstracting away from the mouth modality, because it's interpreting oral face versus hands, it's doing this orally and hand wise, given that it was already abstracted away from the modality and already involved in interpreting the external world and a possible progenitor of a communicative system that was sitting waiting to be recruited, the reason that that tissue then ultimately takes on the control of vocal functions is because it was already multimodal tissue abstracting away from the modality and already interpreting social events, social acts.
Yeah, you want to relate that to birds? I mean, there's this, as I understand, birds also use the left hemisphere tissue that's roughly homologous to ours. Is that right? For yes. Songs?
Yes. I find that very exciting. That gives us possible mechanisms for why it is that language could have evolved the way it does. It didn't come out of nothing. And we will share aspects of this with other living organisms because we didn't come out of nothing. So it's very tantalizing, this hypothesis by Rizzolatti and Arbid, that this tissue, which was discovered in monkeys, might give us a clue as to how it is that, how we can solve that neuroanatomical conundrum. How is it that vocalizations got dragged up and controlled by this tissue? Because brain-wise, that's enormous landscape. You could be going, it's like going to another planet.
With, in birds, it might be a similar mechanism?
Yes, it could be a similar mechanism. I think what's interesting about this is if it were true, what kinds of data might we need to see? And we need to see that aspects of Broca's tissue, again, that we hold so near and dear to our hearts and think is exclusive to a speech production, is also involved in the representation of the hand. And there's been quite an impressive amount of research from converging evidence from a phaseology, from fMRI studies, and from single cell recording, not with humans, but that aspects of the Broca's tissue is involved in the representation of the hands for us. And there's a lot of work on this now. Meaningful hands are represented in Broca's tissue. Again, I'm very not in deaf people. I'm talking about you and me. It's very exciting that we're finding glimpses of where this capacity, this again, what you're seeing toppling down is this notion of unimodality in the brain. We're finding that these sites of tissue that we thought were the exclusive processing of certain modality are actually being challenged now. Yes?
I was thinking about when babies begin their babbling by mimicking and how that's kind of related to what you were discussing with Focus Area 5 and animal mimicking. Is there a difference in tissue use when babies leave off mimicking and start producing original material? Is that sort of,
it's a wonderful question. We don't have the answer, and that's one of the experiments I proposed in my new NERS equipment. Abigail Bard, who was here, do you know Abigail? She was at Harvard, Jerry Kagan's student. She actually did object permanence in children, little babies, looking at them at 6 months old and 10 months old and 12 months old. And at 6 months old, they didn't have object permanence, and she found very bilateral activation. At 10 months old, when they started to have object permanence, she found more a shift from bilateral to left hemisphere to front in very young babies. So it's using NERS technology. So she's my colleague now, and we're going to ask the kinds of questions you just asked. So it's a great question. Yes.
You know how when babies are born, they have the ability to take in or to interpret like 120 sounds, but then they only end up using the ones that are part of their language, their native language, and then they don't recognize the other ones or they're not able to make them with their mouth. What would the analogy be for sign language? Would, if you were making signs and you were making signs from another language, would it just be not recognizable, not picked up as?
It's a great question. Wow. At this year's Society for Neuroscience, Stephanie Baker and I are presenting the results on this study. We took hearing babies who had never been exposed to spoken language. I'm sorry, they've been exposed. Hearing babies who were exposed to normally everyday hearing babies. And we showed them sign phonetic contrast. We did it at 4 months old and 14 months old, where you see the two anchor points. At 4 months old, they were able to phonetically discriminate the hand, phonetic hand units in sign language, cross-modally, even though they had never been exposed to sign language. But at 14 months old, they couldn't do it. They lost it. Yeah. So that's being presented this year, April, at the SRCG. Yes.
Now that cochlear implants are a lot more popular, there's a lot of controversy about deaf parents not wanting their children to have that because they want them to be from the deaf community. It seems like your argument sort of blows the developmental piece out of the water, and that being deaf is not a developmental delay on young children. I was wondering if you had any feel on that.
Yes. I mean, what's interesting is that deaf people have used the culture argument, and that's very alien to hearing people. What do you mean you have a culture? I don't understand that. Okay? The hearing people hearing this are appalled. The truth of the matter is that there's a much more powerful biological argument. With biology, the brain teaches us that it does not discriminate, that development is normal, that there is no atrophy. The whole argument for cochlear implant is get in there early, the brain tissue is going to die. We're going to lose them to the deaf world. Completely and utterly biologically false. It's just false. Yes.
But if that children exposed to second language at late age, they use a different area of the brain when they use a second language. How is it different?
Okay. How is it? Okay. Let me just say one thing, that you can learn languages later in life, and you can be very proficient in them. That's a proficiency thing in social communication. I've been intrigued with whether or not there are differences in the brain. The answer is yes, there are differences in the brain. So I don't want to confuse age of exposure with proficiency. You can be very proficient and learn a language. But does that mean there's no critical period effect for second language acquisition? Yes, there is. The brain honors a distinction, and the way it does it is if you are late exposed bilingual, you use more of your frontal lobe, number one. What is the frontal lobe doing? The frontal lobe is allocating a lot of attentional and inhibition resources. It's slowing down the process. You do a little bit slower processing. It doesn't mean you can't be proficient, but proficiency and age of impact on the brain are two different things. So yes, it's more frontal, and I just want to say it's more bilateral. The later you're exposed to a second language, the more bilateral your language representation will be for that second language.
So they use the same areas, reflexion, temporal, like basic.
Oh yeah, the same basic areas, plus a heavier reliance on the frontal lobe and more bilateral activation. Yes.
Is that at least in part because when you're at a later age, when you're learning a new language, you're translating it through your first language?
That is definitely one of the hypotheses. If that's definitively why, we don't know. But I would certainly think that's going to be on the list of possible reasons why. Yes.
Good question. Why did you reject the neural networks approach right away? Why can't we say that there is a certain window of sensitivity, no matter what modality it is, whether you're deaf, blind, like Helen Keller, you get tactile pattern recognition.
Right.
Why can't you just have a network that learns to detect those patterns within their one window?
You do have a network.
Not have it.
Chimps don't have this. In fact, while chimps have a planum, the structure, it's not doing the job that it does for us. But let me get back. In fact, we know this because we know from various patterns of sequencing breakdown, for example, aspects of dyslexia and aspects of autism, they have atypical activity in the superior temporal gyrus. Well, that's not an accident because something's the matter. And we know that if you have some kind of deficit, some kind of functioning that's atypical in the superior temporal gyrus, we see patterns of where language would break down. Well, the way in which we look at a chimp, we see in a chimp, chimps reach the ceiling of language capacity that an organism could have if it didn't have a functioning superior temporal gyrus. So guess what they don't have? No chimpanzee ever on this planet has ever been attributed to have phonological knowledge. Nobody. Not even the major projects that want to say apes have language. Nobody has said they had phonology. And no nobody said they had syntax. Well, they said it, but then they took it back. So, phonotactic. Guess what you wouldn't have if you don't have a properly functioning spirit temple gyrus? You'd have that. Well, chimps don't have that. So we can predict the feeling of what a chimp knows based on this fact. Now, just let me tell you, neural nets. There's strong connectionism and weak connectionism. Strong connectionism, which is that there's absolutely nothing dedicated. The brain is neuronal soup. Doesn't hold water. Weak connectionism. Yes. Weak connectionism is suited. I wouldn't say ideal. It's suited. Because the thing is, it's not that there's, you still have to put in your hidden unit a sensitivity to something that's going to get your phonology out on the other end. Okay? So it's not a blank slate. It has to have some pre-designed sensitivity. So if you have connectionism that's going to put in pre-designed connections, then it's not connectionism. But some connectionists will call it connectionism.
Grossberg was one of the innovators, early innovators in connectionism, and he's always argued for what you're saying, that you have to have a network that's specific for a particular function,
okay,
not just a vanilla
right
network.
Okay. I agree with the weak version.
Right.
Strong version.
Anyway, thank you.
You're welcome.